is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. There's no easy way to separate a child from their home. Community advocates work to make child protective services separations less jarring.
Not only do these kids lose the only home they may have ever known, but then they lose those community supports that, you know, often teach them resilience.
That story and more coming up this West Virginia Morning. Support for West Virginia Morning is proudly provided by Luke Frazier. For the first time in the 33-year history of the prestigious James Beard Foundation Culinary Awards, West Virginia has a winner. Maria Young reports.
The moment the winner of the Best Chef Southeast category was announced in Chicago Monday night.
And the James Beard Award goes to Paul Smith, 1010 Bridge.
Hundreds of fans gathered at the Capitol Market in Charleston erupted in joy for their now famous friend, but also for their state. At the podium, Smith, too, celebrated the Mountain State recognition.
Two words that have never been mentioned here before, West Virginia.
The award recognizes exceptional talent in the culinary arts as well as the commitment to racial and gender equity and what the foundation calls a culture where we can all thrive.
I've received so many messages from so many chefs from around the state saying thank you. Thank you for shedding some light on what we do and that we are a culinary force to be reckoned with.
Smith was a finalist in the same category last year. He estimates 10 to 15% of the business at his restaurant, 1010 Bridge, now comes from out-of-state visitors who heard about him that way. State Tourism Director Chelsea Ruby in the crowd said the award shines a well-deserved spotlight on West Virginia.
It puts us on the map. When you think about culinary destinations, this absolutely puts us on the map.
Governor Jim Justice said in a Facebook post that the award attracts visitors from around the world to experience the taste of almost heaven. For the crowd gathered to support Chef Paul, the impact his award will have on this state is worth celebrating. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Maria Young in Charleston.
The federal government gave the Mountain Valley Pipeline permission to begin service Tuesday despite lingering public concerns about the safety of the long-delayed project. The Federal Energy Commission's Office of Energy Projects gave its approval late Tuesday, only a day after the pipeline's builder, Equitrans Midstream, declared the project mechanically complete. Terry Turpin, the director of the Office of Energy Projects, told Equitrans that the 303-mile natural gas pipeline was in compliance with environmental and safety requirements. Turpin cited recent construction status reports, agency compliance monitoring, and a staff inspection conducted May 13th through 17th. In contrast, dozens of comments opposing the authorization entered into the FERC public case docket in recent weeks. Landowners, environmental groups, and state lawmakers, as well as county commissioners, based their opposition in part on a May 1st rupture of the pipeline during pressure testing in Bent Mountain, Virginia. Neither regulators nor Equitrans have disclosed the cause of the rupture or whether they will share the results of a metallurgical analysis. Two companies are working side by side to build a new titanium plant in Jackson County powered by solar. Curtis Tate went to take a look.
The sounds of heavy construction equipment puncture the air on bottomland near the Ohio River. Within the next year or so, a factory will rise from the ground. A company called Timet will make titanium parts for use in the aerospace industry, and it will be powered by solar panels across State Highway 2. Berkshire Hathaway's BHE Renewables is building the solar facility with battery storage. Here's the project's manager, Vic Sprouse.
So it's the first solar microgrid in the country. We're going to be right across the street from Timet, and we are going to start grading that area over there, and eventually you'll see solar panels go up, you'll see a battery system in place, and we will be providing a portion of the power towards TIMET.
Aaron Valentine, Director of Operations for TIMET, a subsidiary of Precision Cast Parts Corporation, says the company intends to source 100% of its power from the solar facility.
You know, the actual amount that the site will need is dependent on how the process evolves and what the capacity ends up looking like, but you know, roughly about 30 megawatts for phase one. Could change, obviously, but so definitely a lot of energy required for the site.
Valentine says the battery system will be key in supplying uninterrupted power to the plant when the sun doesn't shine. Even then, the plant will be connected to the grid.
There will be a connection to the utility as a backup. As you can imagine, with the products we make, you don't have an interruption if it were to be a problem. So we will have a backup supply with utility.
Depending on when it's finished and how much power TIMET needs, the solar facility could produce as much as 100 megawatts of electricity. Currently, the largest solar plant in the state, in Monongalia County, produces 19 megawatts. Sprouse says BHE Energy will adjust its output according to TIMET's needs.
So as TIMET ramps up, whatever their needs are is what we will help provide them.
BHE Energy hasn't settled on what battery storage technology it will use. Form Energy will soon begin building long-duration storage batteries at its West Virginia plant under construction in Weirton.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something definitely worth looking into, because that would fit kind of the profile that we're looking at for the site. So, I don't know if those conversations are being had, but I think it would be a good opportunity to at least evaluate it.
The area has a rich manufacturing history. Nearby, Constellium makes aluminum parts for the aerospace industry. What was Century Aluminum is also close by. Sprouse says the microgrid could represent how such manufacturing is powered in the future.
Being able to provide a facility that's going to have this significant energy use that's producing some of the, some of the top end titanium in the world, for highly specialized needs, having the some portion of their energy come from renewables, I think is exciting and probably the future of the way we're going to do it.
By late in the year, the solar panels should be visible. And by next year, they should be powering the titanium factory. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Ravenswood.
TIMET is hiring, and to find a listing of jobs, go to our website at wvpublic.org. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:51. Areas of fog this morning, partly sunny skies today, highs in the 70s and 80s, clear overnight with lows in the 50s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the 80s, partly sunny on Friday with a chance of rain and thunderstorms, highs in the 80s. Even in ideal circumstances, the removal of a child from their home by Child Protective Services is always traumatic. Emily Rice spoke with community advocates about that process and what resources children need to adapt.
There is no easy way to take a child away from the only home they have ever known, according to Kelly Caseman, executive director and founding member of Think Kids West Virginia, a children's advocacy group.
Even if they're living in a home where they're abused or neglected, they still, usually love mom and dad very much.
The number of children in foster care in West Virginia increased by 57% between 2012 and 2021, according according to the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. Most experts in the field attribute the increase to the ongoing opioid epidemic in the region. Shanna Gray is the state director of West Virginia Court-Appointed Special Advocates, or CASA, and a foster parent. She said the reason for removal will dictate how and what the process looks like for the child and family separation, and the process will differ from state to state. For example, a family working with CPS to improve their circumstances would have a safety plan in place, making the transition less jarring for the child if they were removed.
Maybe the child isn't fully separated, parents aren't losing rights or anything, but the child goes and stays with grandma for a week, you know, a 7-day period to say, hey, mom and dad, you know, get this resolve, whatever we are requiring. We'll be back in a week to check in and see. So it might be a temporary separation during that safety plan. Those different types of safety plans are unique.
However, in cases where children are determined to be in immediate danger, separation is far more abrupt.
Very jarring. It's very difficult. It's tough. Sometimes kids in these situations, obviously age dependent, they don't have a scope of what they have been or have been experiencing is always, they don't always know that what they're experiencing is not the same as what other people experience.
While Gray is familiar with the removal process, CASA does not get involved until the case goes to court.
We're the child advocate from a community lens. So when there's a child abuse and neglect proceeding before the circuit court, the family and child have a CPS worker, of course, and that's the social services side. They have a guardian ad litem who is appointed to them, and that's the attorney and the lawyer side. The parent also has either a public defender or a parent's respondent attorney. And then in areas where CASA is available, the judge may appoint a community advocate or a CASA volunteer.
The CASA volunteer is independent and objective, according to Gray. They conduct an investigation and compile recommendations for the judge to disseminate to all parties in the case. In the past, out-of-state placements isolated the children and impeded their progress, according to Caseman.
Often when a child isn't getting that love and attention at home, they look for it at school, and they often get it there. And so not only do these kids lose the home, the only home they may have ever known, but then they lose those community supports that, you know, often teach them resilience and support.
Both Caseman and Gray advocate for community support to help children in the custody of an overburdened system.
But what we're not doing is really working collaboratively to ensure that people know where those services are, where they can be referred to, and then identify the gaps of where there are no services. And we do know that there are definitely places in the state where there are just no services at all.
Gray said CASA's work is defined by the guiding principle that children grow and develop best with their family of origin when that can be safely achieved. She cited a study from the University College London and King's College London that found when a child grows up in foster care, that child has an 80% higher chance of developing a long-term terminal illness.
Young people really internalize about being in foster care. What did I do? How did I become into foster care? Why this happened to me? Was it my fault? And so all of those mental impacts have very real long-term mental, emotional, social, and physical outcomes.
According to West Virginia's Child Welfare Dashboard, of West Virginia's more than 6,000 foster children, 38% were placed in certified kinship or a relative's home. 27% are receiving therapeutic foster care at stabilization and treatment homes. If you suspect or know that a child is being abused or neglected, call the Central Intake for Abuse and Neglect at 1-800-352-6513. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Emily Rice in Charleston.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Bill Lynch, Brianna Heaney, Chris Schultz, Curtis Tate, Emily Rice, Eric Douglas, Jack Walker, Liz McCormick, and Maria Young. Chris Schultz produced today's show. I'm your host, Teresa Wills. This is West Virginia Morning.